It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, we have the pleasure of having Sarah Mitchell on our program once again, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Sarah, welcome to you.
Hello.
Chris Larimer joins us, Associate Professor of Political Science, Professor of Political Science, at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ben.
Well, we have a lot to get to today. We hope our listeners will join in as well. Later in the hour, we want to talk about the June 2nd primaries. Fast approaching, just 4 weeks ago, Iowa's June 2nd primaries. In the age of COVID-19, handshakes and campaign rallies are out. Digital connections are in. So I want to quiz Sarah and Chris about how this primary campaign will be different than others. Also, reaching out to our listeners, are you planning to vote in the upcoming primary? How will you decide who gets your vote? We'd like to have you join our conversation a little bit later in the program, 1-866-780-9100. Well, let's first talk about the visit Friday. Mike Pence, our vice president, will visit Iowa. He'll be in Des Moines to take part in discussions related to the pandemic. According to the news release from the White House, Pence will meet with faith leaders to discuss reopening religious services to the public, also visit Hy-Vee's headquarters to hold a roundtable discussion about securing the nation's food supply. Of course, in our news in the last couple of weeks, many meatpacking plants, not only here in the Midwest, but across the country, hit hard by the coronavirus, leading to closures, a disruption of the nation's food supply chain. State health officials reporting yesterday that more than 1,600 workers at four Iowa meatpacking plants have been infected with the virus. Separately from this, the vice president's visit to Iowa yesterday, Governor Reynolds said she would travel to meet with the president and the vice president at the White House this week. Here's a little bit of her voice. At yesterday's coronavirus briefing, Governor Kim Reynolds confirmed she would be traveling to the White House for this meeting with Trump administration officials.
I'm actually going to be following several governors that have had an opportunity to sit down with the president, the vice president, and the team and talk about what they're doing in their states. I think Governor Cuomo, Murphy, Edwards, Governor Lee, and Governor DeSantis has gone before me. So I will be going to give him an update on what we're doing in Iowa and really talk about how testing and case investigation, our assessment, really working with our processing plants and how we've tried to be proactive in that respect to give him an update on that and to thank them for their assistance throughout the process.
Governor Reynolds went on to say that she would be flying to D.C. on a private plane that would be paid for by campaign funds. Chris, kick us off here. What do you make of these visits? Why the White House giving Iowa Governor Reynolds all this attention?
Well, I imagine it's probably a combination of, the national attention that Iowa is receiving regarding the outbreak, particularly at the meatpacking plant, the Tyson meatpacking plant in Waterloo. I think, you can read a little bit of politics into this in terms of looking ahead to the 2020 election. Iowa is still seen as one of those battleground states and maybe edging more competitive than folks initially thought it might be following the 2016 election. And, I think it also relates to just the overall response to the pandemic. I mean, if you remember, Iowa is one of those few states that did not order any sort of shutdown. There were shutdowns of certain parts of the economy within Iowa, but it wasn't the shutdown that we saw in other states. And so I think, there are certainly health factors there are economic factors, but I think there are probably political factors as well, whether or not people will admit it. But I mean, Iowa, again, as I said, is one of those states that's going to be critical for 2020. I think we've seen a tightening of the politics in the state in terms of the competitiveness between the Democratic and Republican parties. And I know we'll talk about the primary races later, but yep. I think just generally statewide, there's been a bit of a tightening. We've seen Democrats making some gains. And I think Democrats nationally, as well as in Iowa, are looking to the 2020 election as an election in which the atmospherics surrounding it may be working in their favor. So I think all of that's kind of feeding into that decision.
Sarah, I want your view, but first let me mention this new polling published this past week showing, quite good approval for Governor Reynolds. 54% of Iowans approving of the way she is handling the coronavirus outbreak. That same poll showing just 46% of Iowans had that same approval opinion of Donald Trump, conducted by researchers from the Harvard Kennedy School, Northeastern University, and Rutgers University. So they surveyed all 50 states here, and respondents in all 50 states gave their governor a better coronavirus response approval rating than they did the president. So in Iowa, we're in keeping with all other 49 states. Comment about this visit of Kim Reynolds to the White House and the vice president coming here. Sarah, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree that Iowa is still facing an increasing number of cases and the health threats with the deep packing plants. So I think this is a good time for coordination between Governor Reynolds and the Trump administration. In terms of the approval, Reynolds is at 54% in that poll that you mentioned, but Governor Cuomo in New York is at 74%. So I think Reynolds has some room there to move upward in terms of the perceived handling of the COVID crisis in Iowa. And also, Iowans in that same poll approve of some business closures to mitigate the COVID-19 spread at 80%. So I think she's looking at a situation here, right? If there's too much opening too quickly, and if those numbers of cases and deaths continue to rise, she has some kind of, there's potential cost for her. On the political side, I would say too that if you look at recent polling numbers for Joni Ernst against potential challengers like Teresa Greenfield, these numbers are not looking good for Ernst. She's at only 37% approval, 43% disapproval. So I think the Republican Party has an incentive to get in Iowa if they're looking to also to boost the what's becoming a very competitive Senate race.
Mm-hmm. We want to talk definitely about that, the Senate race. This will be her first reelection bid, Joni Ernst. And on the Democratic side, we have a primary with four competitors there for that Democratic nomination for the right to face Joni Ernst as a Democratic nominee. Let's talk a little bit more about the governor. Sarah, I'm very interested in you mentioned Governor Cuomo with 74% of the people said they approve of the job in New York, New York State, that their governor is doing, 54% for Governor Reynolds. So what are your thoughts on why governors are across the board getting better approval ratings than the president?
Well, I think, first of all, governors have been really very effective at the public messaging on the virus situation. So Reynolds, for example, has been doing, public press meetings basically every day and giving Iowans information. So, and I think a lot of governors across the United States have been very effective with that messaging. I also think people know that the states have been really proactive in, being the first line of response to the coronavirus. And so it's not just governors that are getting the boost. It's also local governments. So in some of these recent polls, Americans are approving very highly of the cities and their local governments in terms of how they're responding. But I was going to mention on Iowa, we see, I think if you look at polls for, say, should Iowa voters get absentee ballots, there's pretty good agreement across the parties. But if you ask them about things like meatpacking plants, then you start to see bigger divergence of opinion. So only 82% of Democrats think that meatpacking plants should be closed until they're safe versus 25% of Republicans in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So this is I think the meatpacking plant issue seems to be one that's has a lot of partisan divides.
Right. And it was not too long ago that the president signed an executive order that said that meat processing plants are part of the nation's critical infrastructure. Now this week we learned that the League of United Latin American Citizens, known as LULAC. This is one of the country's largest Latino organizations, calling for a boycott of processed meat due to outbreaks of the coronavirus at meatpacking plants. These are facilities that employ thousands of workers, many of them immigrants and refugees. LULAC is calling on consumers to join an effort they're calling Meatless May. Chris, up there in the Waterloo Cedar Falls area, I'm looking at from where you are right now. I don't know if you saw this chart in the New York Times today that shows among the 10 metropolitan areas in the country with the most new confirmed virus cases per capita, half are home to meat processing plant where workers evidently have the virus. In that chart of top 10 metro areas with the most new confirmed viruses cases per capita, there is Sioux City, Grand Island, Nebraska, also where you are, Chris, the Waterloo Cedar Falls area. So what does this boycott and this information, the focus on the meat packing plants, say about our growing Latinx influence here in Iowa?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's certainly a concern up here. There's some anxiety surrounding it, but I think it's still a little bit early or difficult to tell the exact political power or influence of the organization of the Latinx group within Iowa. I mean, you know, you look at the demographics of Iowa, and looking this morning on the census website and just their kind of their quick facts updates that they do for on a state-by-state basis, and Hispanic, or as they say, Hispanic or Latino portion of the population in Iowa is still at 6.2%. So it, as far as the proportion within the population, is still relatively small, but it is growing. And I think, you know, you see that across the country where the Latinx population is growing, which would mean that, you know, if they are able to mobilize, they're going to be continue to exert more political influence, whether it's in a primary election or a general election. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was going to go back to the point Sarah was making earlier, too, regarding the difference between how voters are viewing governors versus how they're viewing the response from the federal government. And I think, you know, Sarah makes a very good point here. Governors, I think, on the whole, have generally had a more measured and less partisan response to the pandemic. They've been perceived as Sarah said, sort of managing the crisis in an effective way, whereas the response from the president has been, I think it's fair to say, somewhat inconsistent and overly partisan, whether that's personal attacks or partisan attacks. And my sense is that we haven't seen that or heard that from governors. And, you know, so you have a more measured response from governors. And it also fits with the overall trend we've seen in public opinion, even before the pandemic, where voters tend to approve of local government more so than state government more so than the federal government. So it's not surprising to see some of those trends in public opinion.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, my guest this hour on this Politics Wednesday, Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller professor of political science at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. Well, we had to talk from the Trump administration. There are plans to disband the coronavirus task force in the coming weeks. Vice President Mike Pence said the decision was, in his words, a reflection of the tremendous progress we've made as a country. Now, this task force, a key part of the president's response, he often, in the past weeks, every evening, sharing the stage with medical experts, Dr. Deborah Birx and Dr. Anthony Fauci, during these televised briefings. This is an announcement that comes that the task force is going to disband in the coming weeks, despite evidence that the outbreak is still raging. Sarah Mitchell, what do you make of this? They seem to run contrary to each other.
Yeah, I think it's a huge mistake to shut down this task force, especially given that Trump is telling Dr. Fauci that he can't testify to Congress, for example. Mm-hmm. So if we don't have officials from the CDC or other administrative bodies going to Congress and talking to them about what's going on, or at least have a clear designation, say, of the CDC as the public face for this crisis. So it's not clear to me in what I'm reading so far about this, what agency will be designated as the voice for this situation, and how are the individuals from that agency going to provide information to the media or to Congress or other actors?
Sarah, let me ask you this. Do you think it has anything to do with the fact that, well, governors across the country have been doing their daily briefings, as has our governor? When the president has been a bigger and bigger part of these briefings, we've seen his poll numbers go down. Is there a connection there with talking of ending, winding down this task force and its briefings?
Oh, absolutely. I think the decline in his approval, which is attributed in part to those briefings, I think his advisors have tried to pull him back from those briefings. And I think, but, you know, not having the daily briefings from the administration is a different thing from saying that you're going to shut down the task force. So
right.
It seems to me that the task force could continue operating and doing its job without the federal daily briefing. So I think...
Right.
I think it's probably a step too far to shut this thing down.
Chris Larimer, has the Corona Task Force of the White House been successful in your eyes? And do you think this is also premature to shut it down or talk of shutting it down in the coming weeks?
Well, I think, you know, talk of shutting it down at the very least sends the perception to voters that somehow the crisis is winding down when the data do not suggest that. So even if the administration says that, you know, Dr. Birx or Dr. Fauci are going to continue to be active within the administration in terms of working on the pandemic, working on the response to the pandemic, you know, the headline that the task force is winding down is sending the perception to voters that somehow this is no longer a crisis or less of a crisis than it was in the past. And that's simply not the case. And so I think, you know, it may be a case of trying to, as you said, you know, control a bit of the politics surrounding the president, because as I said earlier, those press briefings would end up spiraling out of control into these partisan attacks. And, you know, voters generally don't like to see those hardcore partisan attacks, and they just drive a bigger wedge between the two parties. And so that, in mm-hmm. part, could be driving, you know, the decline in the approval rating of the president. But again, the perception of winding down the task force, I think, probably sends the wrong message.
Mm-hmm. We have 4 or 5 minutes before we have to take a break. Let's talk about this. And in our second half of our program, we'll dive into talk of the primaries with the primary election coming up in less than a month. But the Senate went back in to Washington for a session that the Congress's top doctor said carried health risks. Given this continued spread of the coronavirus, senators across the country traveling back to the Capitol in time for a confirmation vote on Monday. Contrast that with the U.S. House not in session. Why one chamber and not the other? One is in the hands of Democrats, the other, the Senate in the majority of the Republicans, Sarah.
Yeah, I think I haven't seen at least a discussion from the House leadership about not returning. But yeah, I think you're right about the differences between the chambers being partisan to some extent. I think what was interesting to me was that the average age for 50% of the Senate is over 65, which I sort of had a sense of that. But when I saw that number, it was even higher than I was expecting. But that tells you, right, that a lot of the senators are in a higher risk group in terms of, you know, being exposed or being in an environment where they have a higher chance of being exposed to coronavirus. And I think a lot of the staffers, right, are nervous in terms of having to go back and be in proximity to others, but also, you know, working in masks and kind of changing the way that they're used right. to interacting.
Very, very different opticals if you see the video footage of this, because, of course, as you mentioned there, Sarah, it's not just 100 senators returning to Washington. It is all the support staff that each of these senators have, also cooks, people who clean the congressional buildings and meeting places. Mitch McConnell, majority leader in the Senate, eager to portray Senate members as essential workers. This is, in a sense, can't you make the argument, Chris, that Mitch McConnell is saying, we are not just expecting those in grocery stores, those doing other essential work, meatpacking, for instance, teachers during this pandemic to show up, we should show up too.
Yeah, I imagine that's the point he's trying to make. But again, to your point, to Sarah's point, this is, you know, it's a very difficult working environment to have, you know, the 100 senators back and the entire staff and everybody else. And then you can imagine if they would have tried to call back the U.S. House with another 435 members and all their staff and all mm-hmm. their staffers, you're talking thousands of individuals coming back to the Capitol. I think it is a bit unusual given, you know, the technology that we have now that you know, you can work remotely. From what I understand from the New York Times reporting today on this, that they are trying to set up a system where they will allow for more remote access for senators, whether that and remote voting potentially, and that's sort of what you would expect, because even the article today just talked about even the logistics of getting to Washington D.C. are much more difficult for senators and their staffers in terms of not having direct flights and trying to coordinate with even just their key staffers or a chief of staff, and so it's a little bit surprising. That they are going back into session, but it may be, as you said, that Mitch McConnell is trying to send a message that if you have, you know, the average American out there still having to report to work, we should too.
Mm-hmm. A couple minutes before we take a break, quickly to sort of set us up for the next hour's conversation, let's talk about the hopes that Democrats have to win back the Senate, a net gain of 3 seats to tie the Senate, 4 seats to take it back into Democratic hands. Before we go to break, Sarah, how realistic now in this new pandemic political environment are the Democrats' dreams of taking not only the White House, but also reclaiming the Senate while holding the House?
Well, I think the chances are getting better because when the economy is performing poorly, and the incumbent party tends to be blamed for that. So I think the Republicans, not just the president, but Republican candidates in general, will be facing some costs for the increasing unemployment. And we already saw a close to 5% drop in gross domestic product in the first quarter. When we see those numbers for the second quarter, it's going to be abysmal. So even though the stock market tends to right now isn't reacting as strongly as we've seen in other sectors of the economy. I think what we're going to be seeing is Republicans are going to focus on the stock market if it continues to perform well, and Democrats are going to focus on unemployment and other aspects of the economy that are hurting everyday people.
Okay, Sarah Mitchell and Chris Larimer will be back in just a moment, and we'll delve into the primaries. June 2nd, primaries in both parties. We'll talk about the Democratic Senate primary for the right to choose to face Joni Ernst. Also, other competitive races, the congressional races, Cindy Axne's, Abby Finkenauer's seats seen as competitive. We'll talk about it when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad you're on board on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, Chris Larimer, and Sarah Mitchell, Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. This half hour, a good part of it, we'll be talking about the primaries coming up on June 2nd, the party primaries, several competitive races in the U.S. House. As far as Iowa's concerned, also a competitive seen as a competitive race, Joni Ernst's first bid at re-election to her Senate seat. Early voting has begun here in Iowa. Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate encouraging Iowans to vote by mail to reduce the risk of spreading the COVID virus. His office mailing absentee ballot request forms to every active registered voter. Let's go to our phones because I see Mary in Iowa City joining us, wants to talk about the primary and voting. Welcome to the program, Mary.
Thank you. Well, I got the card from Paul Pate, but I haven't gotten the ballot back yet. And it was supposed to go into Johnson County. So that was over a week ago, and I want to know, when is the deadline?
I don't know that. I don't know if Chris or Sarah know that, but, you know, these things take time, and we do have almost a month before the primary. Would you imagine, Chris, Mary shouldn't be too alarmed?
Yeah, I didn't quite catch the end of her question about the deadline, but it sounded like she hadn't received her absentee ballot request yet. Is that correct?
Well, I got the postcard, and I filled it out, and I sent it back in, and it's supposed to go to Johnson County, but I haven't gotten the ballot yet. And I don't want to, you know, go past the deadline because I think the man who, Mr. Pate, is a Republican, and all he has to do is stop the pipeline for Democrats, and we're going to have problems.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Chris.
I think she's probably okay as far as the actual ballot not getting back to her yet. I think you're right. There's probably still a little bit of time there as it works through the system. I think that should be. She might be able to wait a little bit longer on that.
Right, and you can always make inquiries and look at the questions that are answered at the Iowa Secretary of State's website. Look for that. Thank you, Mary, for your call. 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk a little bit about these competitive races, starting with the Senate race. Joni Ernst, in her first bid for reelection, facing, well, Democratic candidates now vying for that nomination, Michael Franken, Kimberly Graham, Teresa Greenfield, Eddie Morrow, and Cal Woods. Sarah, what do you make of this field of Democratic primary candidates?
Well, I think they're starting to get more active on the virtual campaign trail. So Greenfield did an event I saw just for fundraising and to try to get to know voters. So I think right now in the public policy polling of 1,222 Iowa voters, she's running neck and neck with Joni Ernst. So I think now is the time for these primary candidates to do as much as they can to, help Democrats in Iowa know who they are and mm-hmm. vote for them in the primaries.
Right, and that's tough. No rallies, no get-togethers in living rooms and so forth. So no face-to-face meetings, right, Chris? This is a different sort of campaign, uncharted territory for any politician.
It is. And, you know, the point you make for Senator Ernst, this is her first reelection campaign, and that's generally when incumbents are the most vulnerable. And so her campaign strategy that they may have laid out a few years ago has been completely upended for running for her first reelection. And, you know, so far this looks to be it seems as though as we keep getting closer and closer to November of 2020, that the race continues to be more competitive. That a couple of the well-known national groups that rank Senate races have moved Iowa's race from likely Republican to lean Republican. Both Cook's Political Report and Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball have done that. And as Sarah mentioned earlier, recent polling on Senator Ernst has her approval rating at less than 50%, which would suggest she is potentially vulnerable this November. And for U.S. senators, and even for congressional seats or seats in the U.S. House, their fate is often tied to the perception of the president if they share party affiliation with the president. And so right now, if the president's approval rating is dropping, you know, that's potentially a burden for Senator Ernst going into November of 2020. And then you can also look at just the fundraising numbers. And the latest fundraising numbers from the first quarter, at least according to opensecrets.org, which tracks fundraising for all congressional candidates, Teresa Greenfield right now has about $3.8 million on hand. And that's considerably more than her other challengers. Eddie Morrow is in second at just over $1 million with cash on hand for the Democratic primary there. But it seems to be that the candidates, or at least the Democrats in Iowa and Democrats nationally, seem to be settling on Teresa Greenfield. She's picked up a lot of big endorsements from Congressman Loebsack, Congressman Finkenauer, former Lieutenant Governor Sally Peterson. So this does seem to be shaping up to a race between Teresa Greenfield and Senator Ernst. And so I'd be surprised if we get to that primary and Teresa Greenfield does not come out on top.
Aside from the Senate, the U.S. House race is seen as competitive. We have interesting cases in all four of our congressional districts now, don't we? Representatives Steve King, a longtime incumbent, the longest serving U.S. House member from Iowa, Cindy Axne, Abby Finkenauer, facing competitive races, as I'm reading, in 2020. This week, we learned that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the largest business lobby in the group in the country, endorsed State Senator Randy Feenstra for the Republican congressional primary nomination against Representative Steve King. Feenstra, one of four Republicans challenging King in Iowa's June 2nd primary. King has represented Northwest Iowa in Congress since 2002. How significant or unusual, Sarah, do you think this endorsement is of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce not endorsing a longtime incumbent?
I think it's highly unusual. The Chamber of Commerce doesn't usually, they don't endorse in that many cases, as I understand it. So that's unusual. I would say on the House as a whole, 538 has a good story today on kind of analyzing the Democrats versus Republicans in terms of who will, you know, can their Democrats can maintain control of the House. And basically, there's a 37-seat advantage right now for the Democrats, 233 seats to 196 for the Republicans. And in looking at the open competitive seats, like my seat here in Johnson County, the Loeb Sack seat, Iowa 2, they find that the Democrats have quite a bit of advantage in a lot of those open competitive seats. So the Republicans would have to flip at least 18 seats to take back the House. And it's looking like it's going to be a difficult challenge for that based on the current polling numbers.
The Democratic candidate in Iowa's 4th Congressional District facing, well, Steve King, or maybe one of the other candidates vying for that nomination, is J.D. Scholten. Remember him from 2018. What a surprise in a district that Trump won by 20-some percentage points, I think. He came within 2 or 3 percentage points of Steve King, losing that battle in 2018, but still a surprising result. Here he is announcing to Twitter followers in April that he'd be running a half marathon through Sioux City to raise money for food and medical supply for farm workers.
I have not trained. I probably should have trained. I probably should have not drank whiskey last night. It is 37 degrees here. The snow has melted, but we snowed the last couple of days. But you know what? I'm going to run from my home all the way to the police department, because we had 3 officers that came down with COVID-19, including our police chief, Rex Mueller. And so in honor of them, I'm going to be running past a hospital as well. And so for the next couple hours, I'm going to be on the go. If you see me, give me a honk. But yeah, here we go.
Okay, J.D. Scholten there. Chris, there's some of that new campaigning, right, in the digital context. Instead of a rally, you run a half marathon through Sioux City to raise money for food and medical supplies for farm workers.
Yeah, and that's a good example of it. And I think, you know, to the point about the endorsement from the U.S. Chamber of Congress or U.S. Chamber of Commerce for Randy Feenstra, I think they're looking ahead to November of 2020 and obviously recognize, as you said, that J.D. Scholten is a very effective campaigner. He has a lot of personal appeal, and, you know, he did come within about 3 percentage points of beating Steve King this last election cycle. And so I think, you know, if they're going into or thinking ahead to November of 2020 and the perception around the Republican Party is perhaps not as positive as it may have been in the past, or, you know, the generic ballot test that pollsters often use to try to get a good read on whether or not the House is going to go Democrat or Republican, if that's leaning more in the Democrats' favor, I think they're looking to Randy Feenstra as someone who is maybe a bit more moderate, certainly less controversial than Steve King, because they know if it's J.D. Scholten as the Democratic nominee, it's going to be another tough race. And I was just looking this morning again on opensecrets.org as far as fundraising for that race. J.D. Scholten has $715,000 on hand. Randy Feenstra has $415,000 on hand. And Steve King, according to this report, has just $26,000 on hand. And so
that's amazing.
And so that is, it's an amazing gap. And so, I think with the Chamber's endorsement, they're looking ahead and wondering, you know, can would Steve King really be able to defeat J.D. Schulten again in what is arguably going to be a tougher election year in 2020 than it was in 2018?
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the question that our caller, Mary, from Iowa City had. In the meantime, we've looked up some information. She had a question about absentee ballots, a lot of mail-in ballots for this primary. Here's information about the deadline, Mary. I hope you're still listening, and others can take advantage of this, too. According to the website, you can return your voted absentee ballot by mail. Absentee ballots received in the county auditor's office by the time the polls close on election day are eligible for counting. Absentee ballots received after the polls close on election day must be postmarked by the Monday before election day or earlier and received in the county auditor's office no later than noon on the Monday following the election. That's from the Secretary of State's website. So you've got plenty of time. That primary slated for June 2nd. Let's talk a little bit more about these competitive races. Abby Finkenauer in the Iowa's 1st District up there where you are, Chris, in northeast Iowa. Let's listen to a little bit of the Republican candidate facing her in Iowa's 1st Congressional District. Ashley Hinson shared an outtake from a video recorded at home online. Let's have a listen.
I was out knocking doors and it was really hot. My husband and one son were on one side of the street and I was on the other side of the street. And
okay. There was that was unplanned, of course. That Ashley Hinson there. How many Zoom meetings have been interrupted by such things over the past few weeks? Sarah Mitchell, many people working from home and here campaigning from home. Hilarious there. What can happen when real life intrudes on campaigning?
Yeah, as a professor who teaches online, I can attest to having disruptions happen, although I don't have any young kids at home anymore, but I know a lot of colleagues experiencing those kind of moments. I think, as Chris was saying earlier, when you're going up for a re-election for the first time, so you're a new incumbent, it can be more difficult. And so I think what is good, I guess, for Finkenauer is that if it's hard for these candidates that are trying to challenge, like Ashley Hinson, they don't have the opportunities to be out there in the public, you know, having those rallies and talking to people. So mm-hmm. So I would say in those cases, the incumbents have an advantage for name recognition. And in the King race, you know, if he, you know, if Feenstra takes the nomination, then I would argue that Schulten has a slight edge because Schulten has a lot of name recognition from running last time. So in that case, it could be good for him because he had this close race the last time around. So I think new incumbents might be better off than they would be normally. But Chris is the expert on this, so I'm sure he can tell me if I'm right or not.
Thanks. You're right, yeah.
Okay. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. A very agreeable guest today, Chris Larimer, Sarah Mitchell. Hey, in the last few minutes here, I wanted to get your take on this news story, switching back to sort of the national view and listening to this ad by this Lincoln Project. Late on Monday, Donald Trump lashing out online against a group of conservative critics who are seeking and have been for many months seeking to undermine his reelection bid. It's a group that includes the attorney George Conway. Now, that's the husband of the White House counselor Kellyanne Conway. The president's tweet storm came in response to this latest anti-Trump advertisement released earlier on Monday by the Lincoln Project. This is a super PAC launched last December by a handful of prominent disaffected Republicans and former party members. The title of this ad, and we'll just hear the audio here, is titled Morning in America. And that's a play on the famous 1984 campaign commercial, that slogan of President Ronald Reagan. The images accompanying this track, desolate, dreary cityscapes, masked faces, even a U.S. flag flying upside down. Here's the audio.
There's mourning in America. Today, more than 60,000 Americans have died from a deadly virus Donald Trump ignored. With the economy in shambles, more than 26 million Americans are out of work, the worst economy in decades. Trump bailed out Wall Street, but not Main Street. This afternoon, millions of Americans will apply for unemployment. And with their savings run out, many are giving up hope. Millions worry that a loved one won't survive COVID-19. There's mourning in America. And under the leadership of Donald Trump, our country is weaker and sicker and poorer. And now, Americans are asking, if we have another 4 years like this, will there even be an America?
Paid for by the Lincoln Project, which is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Now, when asked by reporters if he wanted to respond to the ad yesterday at the Joint Base Andrews, here's what the president had to say about that ad.
These are losers from day one. Guys like Bill Kristol. He's 0-32. George Conway, you take a look at him. Just take a look at that guy. The man's a stone-cold loser. So they should not call it the Lincoln Project. It's not fair to Abraham Lincoln, a great president. They should call it the Losers Project. Okay, thanks.
Okay, Sarah, you take a crack at it. What do you make of these disaffected conservative critics of the president? I think they've endorsed Biden, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I think we saw, even during the election of Trump, you know, there were some Republicans that were not supporting him, and then some of them who have left the party as a result of the, you know, cooperation between the Republican Party and the president. And so this group is one of those that's putting out these kind of ads. I went back and looked at the original Reagan ad, and I think that one's kind of interesting because it's focusing on how there's low unemployment, low interest rates. There's an image of a young couple able to buy a home. And so I think it is kind of a clever ad in terms of taking the very positive spin of that Reagan ad and flipping it into a negative ad. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of these kind of ads. There was another ad I mentioned on a previous program that shows it's a speech of Reagan talking about, are you better off now than you were under Carter? But using that language to be talking about the Trump administration right now. So I think this is very interesting how some of these ads are going back to successful campaign ads from the past.
Right. In the final minute or so, Chris, let's not forget that the president, according to polls, still very popular with Republicans overall. 80-90% of Republicans approving. Is that, am I in the right range?
Yeah, I believe so. I haven't looked at the numbers today, but I mean, that's been, you know, one of the stable factors of his presidency is how little his approval ratings have moved. There have been some fluctuations there, and it's generally in that 45 to maybe 49% range for voters overall. But on the whole, Republicans have generally remained very approving of the presidency. And you know, as political scientists have discussed consistently over the last few years, is just how strong partisanship is and how that's a perfect example of the strengthening of partisanship and party identification that, you know, we've seen so many things happen over the last several years, but you really haven't seen any movement away from the president among his co-partisans, among Republican voters. And so that's, you know, I think everybody's looking for that point where we get to where maybe Republicans do move away from the president, or what does it take for Republicans to do that? And so far we haven't seen that in polling. Now, I think in polling, though, there has been some movement away among voters who would say they're independent, that they are, that their approval rating of the president has been dropping recently.
Okay.
And the gender gap is large,
okay.
I would say.
Right.
To be continued, yeah. As always, our political discussion. Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Chris Larimer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Sarah, Chris, thank you very much for your insights. Stay well, stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, have you ever wondered who invented clothing, who performed the first surgery? I'll talk with science writer Cody Cassidy tomorrow on the program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.